Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The tech industry is estimated to create anywhere from 350,000 to 400,000 jobs this year. And with such a big demand, TechCorp is working with schools to bring computer science education to underrepresented groups. This past month, they appointed four new members to their board of directors, including an alum of the program. Joining us now is Lisa Chambers, CEO of TechCorp. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
And also Marjorie Mendez, graduate of the TechCorp program, who credits it with shaping her career path. She is now a senior analyst at Nationwide Insurance and the first TechCorp alum to join the TechCorp National Board of Directors. Welcome to All Sides, Marjorie.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Lisa, let's start off with you. Tell us a little bit about what TechCorp does both here in Ohio and nationally.
Sure. So TechCorp is a national nonprofit organization. We're headquartered here in Columbus, but as you mentioned, we work across the country. And just at our core, Amy, we believe that all kids should have the opportunity to build skills, increase confidence, and open the door to a successful future. And we do that by developing career-connected technology programs for students and teachers in the K-12 educational space.
And as technology rapidly changes, has TechCorp had to evolve in the past few years? Do your core classes remain the same, or are you changing it constantly?
Oh, my goodness. So TechCorp is celebrating its 30th anniversary mm-hmm. this year. And one of the things that I tell folks is the reason that we're still around is because we have continued to evolve as the needs of students and teachers, educators, even employers in this technology space have evolved. So, yeah, what TechCorp does today looks way different than what it did mm-hmm. in 1995. You know, we're as we prepare for our 30th anniversary, our founder was reflecting on, you know, when he started TechCorp, you know, you had desktop computers and now you have computers on your wrist. So yes, we are constantly thinking about the what's next and making sure that we're providing programs that empower students and teachers with the skills that they need to be successful.
What age focus are most people who are working with TechCorp?
We start with third graders. So mm-hmm. we work with students across the board. When we think about our elementary and middle school students, you know, our primary goals are really to provide students with an opportunity to begin to build awareness and exploration. Once we have students in our high school programs, then we're really doing some deeper dives with them. So in these programs, we're so excited. Students are spending anywhere from 100 to 300 hours in programming, and they are earning the credentials that they need for high school graduation. So whether that's pre-apprenticeship certificates, industry-recognized credentials, work-based learning hours, all of that, that really get them prepared not just to graduate from high school, but to begin thinking about their next steps beyond.
And Marjorie, you're an alum of the program. What was your experience like with it?
Well, I have nothing but good things to say about TechCorp. I mean, it's now, it was part of my upbringing, childhood. I mean, it was there for me and throughout all of high school. So I have so many memories with it. But I think when at the time, I didn't think of it much as like, oh, this is going to change my life. I thought, oh, it's just fun being here. I like going through these tech programs and being able to interact with these tools, these computers. We did robotics at one point that you just didn't have access to at home. I felt like, wow, all this stuff is opening up for me, and all I have to do is just show up.
So it was a part of your school day, right?
It was after school.
Oh, it's after school. Okay. I didn't understand that. So you chose to
yes.
stay after school and do this.
Yes, exactly. It's because in where my community, after you're done with high school, you just go straight home. There's not really anything to do. When you're at home, I didn't have access to the internet. Mm. So when this opportunity came to me, it felt like a fun after school club.
Yeah, Lisa, hearing someone who didn't have access to the internet at home stay after school to work on computer programming, that just has to be like your goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the students that participate in the program, you know, we we work with all students, Anne, but we really want to make sure that we're connecting with students and in communities where the access to technology and to technology exposure is low. Because as you'll see, you know, with Marjorie, it's not a lack of skill. Often it's just a lack of opportunity. And so Marjorie is downplaying her experience, but I mean, she was proactive, right? A high school student that says, hey, I'll stay for 3 hours after school to continue to learn about something, or I'll do 150 or 200 hours in the summer to boost my skills. That's huge, right? I mean, because she could have been just sitting on the couch watching TV or doing whatever teenagers
do. Did you get extra credits to help you with graduation or for your degree after?
I was actually looking at the timeline, and that was the first time that Tech Court was at my high school. Mm-hmm. So it was a brand new program. And no, I didn't get anything. All I think
you got everything, but nothing. Yeah. Nothing.
But you can tell them what really drew you in. Yeah.
I want to say I have a side story. So when I was younger, I always wanted to help out my mom. So I would go into the schools and there'd be like flyers everywhere for like food pantry or like things to do, just family programs. And one of the flyers had a free laptop. And I was like, a free laptop? Who's giving out free laptops? And I saw it was Career Computer Core. Mm-hmm. I signed up, and I was sitting there, and all I was thinking is like, so they're basically going to gift us all this laptop and all this extra stuff for just to learn, just to sit here and learn? I'm getting paid to learn, guys. It was unheard of. And it's ever since then, I kind of have this mindset. I'm like, oh, I get paid to learn everywhere I go.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking about training for technology jobs of tomorrow with Lisa Chambers, CEO of Tech Corps. And that was Marjorie Mendez, a graduate of the Tech Corps program, who has now joined the group's National Board of Directors. So we'll get to that National Board of Directors in a second, but you are right now, Marjorie, working for Nationwide Assurance as a senior analyst, and you credit your Tech Corps experience with getting that job. Tell me, what do you do for, what is that job? What is a senior analyst?
So a senior analyst, it is a title that they bestowed on me, but like I said, it continues on from my experiences in Tech Corps. Depending on the teams you're on, I am in the technology operations team, so we work on making sure that our IT division is working as smoothly as possible, and the way to do that is we use a tool named ServiceNow, and I specialize in becoming a subject matter expert on making sure this tool is doing ITSM, IT service management. And this tool is so huge and so vast that I have to learn it holistically and then try to choose, pick in parts where I want to like put my most effort in to help my team accomplish these goals of helping IT service management inside a Nationwide. Mm-hmm. So again,
well, Nationwide's a huge company, so the IT service is very important for them. Yeah.
So it's like their backbone and making sure that right now we're having I don't know if I can say that.
That's okay. That's okay. Yeah. Well, then, so, you know, Tech Corps got you exposed to this. Mm-hmm. Did you think, I mean, if looking back before you did Tech Corps, what did you think you would do for a job?
So before, when I was going through Tech Corps, I had a lot of fun in the program, but I didn't think technology would be my main career. So mm-hmm. I pivoted and I went into video production for a time. Mm-hmm. And when I was in video production, again, all those skills came in handy. Being able to be resourceful with your time, being able to read between the lines and see, like, nobody's going to give you the answers up front. You need to be able to figure those things out on your own. I think that the program has a lot of those situations that kind of incubate students to be able to kind of think on their own. So when I was in video production, I had to use all those skills. But then when COVID hit, I lost my job at the time. And then, I don't know, maybe just sitting in my room, I remembered about Perscolas. I was like, oh, wait, yeah, there's this person who came into the Tech Corps program, talked about us, and after you graduate, please come to our program and we'll help you get ready, an apprenticeship, or get you job ready for the technology market. And you didn't have to have a bachelor's, you just had to be a high school graduate. Mm. So I just remembered all of a sudden, and that's where it started off, getting deeper into the technology industry.
And Lisa, tell me about inviting Marjorie to join the board. What does it mean to you to have an alum on the board?
Well, one of the things that we're really focused on is elevating the student voice in our programs. And so we're thinking about ways that we would do that. So certainly at bringing an alumni onto the board so that she, who has a real experience, can make sure that the conversations we're having that'll shape the future of the organization going forward, have a student around the table that's helping us have those conversations. We're also bringing students in to help with the design of our curriculum. Mm-hmm. So we have some internships there. And this summer, we'll have a couple of junior instructors actually in program. So it's just really important for us to make sure that student voice is elevated within our organization. And when we thought about the alum to invite for this first experience, you know, I couldn't have thought of anybody better and better prepared than Marjorie.
And she said that what drew her in was this idea where it was like, you can get a free laptop if you take these classes. Tell me about that.
So we have some really great partners. So the program that Marjorie participated in was a partnership that we have with the Franklin County Commissioners. Mm-hmm. And students who successfully complete the program, the academic year program, and success means that they attend 80% of, you know, the classes, that they complete their projects and receive digital badges, and that they get recommendation from the staff that they've worked with, those students then can qualify to get a laptop at the end of the experience. Mm-hmm. Those students then can go on in the summer, and we have a program that's similar to a summer youth employment program, but that puts students in a simulated technology company. And so Marjorie completed a program we have called Student Web Corps. So basically, mm-hmm. she was in a simulated web development company for the summer. Mm-hmm. Students are paid. And I think one of the things that Marjorie mentioned was that it's not just the technical skills that the students build in Tech Corps programs. It's really those durable skills that regardless of what students decide to do post-graduation, that these are skills every employer is going to say we need. You know, we need someone that is a creative thinker, that works well in teams, that can articulate and advocate for themselves. And those are things that are all integrated into a Tech Corps program, whether you're a third grader participating in one of our summer camps or you're a high school student that's participating in one of our pre-apprenticeship programs.
Now, looking at Ohio, there's a bill before the House now. It's called House Bill 623. No one likes the numbers, but, you know, it would require school districts to offer high school computer science courses. What does that mean for Tech Corps?
Oh, we are completely supportive of that bill. And I would also say that we want to make sure that teachers are receiving the support that they need to support that requirement. So I think that superintendents and principals and teachers understand the importance of making computer science available to students in their schools. I think that it's just a hard lift because, you know, we need to make sure that teachers have the training. We need to make sure that we have enough teachers that do that. And what that means for an organization like Tech Corps, Anne, is that's where we come in, that we understand that our schools can't do it alone. So organizations like Tech Corps that can leverage community resources, that can engage with students outside of those school time hours to make sure that it's really going to be an all hands on deck to make sure that our kids in this country have the skills that they need for where we're headed.
There's a big push to make Ohio, you know, the Silicon Valley of the heartland. There's lots of tech companies moving in. I mean, Intel has been delayed, but that's beside the point. You know, we're going to have a lot of tech jobs here. What does it mean to have to have students know that they can get those jobs? Like, you know, it's one of those things where if you don't see it and you don't think about it, you don't think that job's for you. How do you tell them, like, yes, you can do this, you can learn this, and we need you to?
Oh, my goodness. It's exposure, right? I think that in our country, we've thought because kids here, at, you know, kind of interact with their first piece of technology before they're 2 years old, that somehow that's going to turn them into a software development or a developer. Or,
yeah.
That it's really more than that, that we need to make sure that we're intentional about giving kids experiences that help them understand these technologies behind these large companies. And research would say that exposure has to start in elementary school. You know, when students begin forming those ideas about who they want to be when they grow up, right? That it's easy for kids to say, I want to be a police officer or a doctor or a veterinarian, because they've had interactions with those folks mm-hmm. in their young lives, and they kind of can visualize what that means. What does it mean to be a software developer or a senior analyst? You know, what mm-hmm. is that? What does that look like? So if you don't have someone that's in that particular industry, you don't have a parent that's coming home and talking about what they did, then how would you know? And what I love about TechCore is that we really cast really wide nets for kids. So you don't have to be at home teaching yourself how to program to get in a TechCore program. You don't have to have any experience. Mm. We want you to come in, we want you to try, and we want you to see. So then you can make the decision about whether or not this is a space for you. And I think what we've seen with students like Marjorie is that once that door is open and that kind of safe and supportive environment, they'll take it from there.
Yeah. Marjorie, just to end, what would you say to someone who is maybe in high school now and has the opportunity to attend this program? How would you convince them that they should stay after school and like put the time in?
I would tell them that they could do it too, as well as like anything they take from TechCore. It's not just some technology skills. Whatever they want to do, technology is become so rampant all around us that it's going to help them so much in the future. And even if they don't want to take the technical skills, the friendship and the community they build, and just being able to have an opportunity to go outside of your comfort zone is always worth it. It's always worth to explore that side of yourself you never knew you had.
Well, thank you so much, Marjorie Mendez, graduate of the TechCore program, who has now joined the group's board of directors. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Lisa Chambers, CEO of TechCore, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Ian.
And coming up, we're going to talk about new ways to meet people. You don't swipe left or right, you go running instead. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich. And this is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. And could a running app be the place where you meet your future partner? With hobby apps like Strava, the social running app, and Letterboxd, a social movie review app, taking over the Gen Z media sphere, people are finding new ways to connect. With 1 in 5 people on Strava going on a date with someone else in the app, is this the future, and is it here already? Joining us now is Catherine Caduto, an associate professor of media science at Boston University and a researcher for online dating and online behavior. Welcome to All Sides, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So looking broadly, how have you seen the dating app market change over the years, especially in the past few years? How has it changed?
It's changed drastically. I mean, it's a really quick change for how relatively new the technology honestly is. Mm-hmm. When you look at the history of online dating and especially dating apps, Tinder and Grindr really only took off in 2012, which is really not that long ago.
Yeah.
But what we've seen, especially since COVID and since lockdown, there's definitely been a shift in what people are prioritizing, what they're interested in, and how they feel about the apps. And so I think it's really interesting to dig into this idea of, like you said, running apps, movie apps, things where people can highlight what they might already have in common, because that's becoming a real cornerstone for building relationships in this age.
Yeah, so making connections through running. So instead of, like I said in the intro, instead of swiping left or swiping right, you now can go for a run together instead. So this is a way to connect and just see if you're a good fit rather than having that awkward dinner date.
Exactly. That's it, exactly. So instead of, you know, swiping on someone, having those kind of awkward initial messages where you're trying to figure out, do we really have anything in common, mm-hmm. as well as just, is this person, you know, who they say they are? With something like a running app, you're already saying, yes, this is something I do. And it's also something that you're going to do regardless of whether you're dating. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also an important part, is you're not really changing an aspect of yourself, or you're not doing something that's totally out of your comfort zone. And that's why so many people have started using things like Strava as a dating app, because it's already saying, you know, I'm a runner. Join me on this run. It gives us something to do. It's something we both enjoy. And then we also have something to talk about.
Yeah. So, I mean, everyone knows that notoriously on dating apps like Tinder, everyone lies, right? So,
yep.
But
oh, yeah.
Right. But it's hard to join a running app if you're not actually a runner. It's a harder lie to keep up, I would say.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's not to say, you know, you might join it because you're interested in starting, mm-hmm. but there is some interest in actually doing the running. You're not going to say, yeah, let's go on a run and then I'll walk behind you.
Right. Like, I can't keep up with you on a run. Yeah. Whenever someone asks you, because in a running app, I can imagine that the first questions are like, what is your pace? Are you training for anything? That's what runners
exactly.
ask. And it's hard to just make that up, because if you say you run a 7-minute mile and you don't, that'll be quite obvious quite quickly.
Exactly.
So another, there's places like Goodreads, which is another place where you can meet people. I never thought about that, but I guess if you are a reader and you want to talk books with people, that's a great place to meet someone.
Definitely. And I think what we're seeing now is kind of an evolution that started on the apps. Really early on, Tinder did do something smart where they integrated Spotify. And I've always thought that was interesting, because with Tinder, you could log in, you could choose like your anthem or your song, and then also connect the rest of your music library. And so even there, you saw people kind of sharing more information beyond what they themselves could type in. And so evolving from that, where, you know, people love being able to talk about the music they have in common, maybe go to shows together, something like Goodreads is a logical evolution of that, where now you're kind of removing the middleman of a Tinder or a Hinge or a Bumble. And you're saying, you know, here's my kind of primary interest. And especially with the growth of book talk and reading in the last couple of years as well, I think Goodreads makes a lot of sense for people who are able to say, let's see what we have in common. And I think with books too, and kind of similar with Letterboxd and movies, you might have a really wide variety of interests. And so maybe you're really like a romance reader, but you're open to suspense. And so maybe you find someone who's really into suspense, and then they can share that with you.
Yeah. Are you finding that people are not just finding partners? They're not looking for someone to date. Are they finding friends this way now?
Definitely. And that, again, is something that has long been associated with the dating apps as well, is that for as many people as you end up swiping on and chatting with, many of them become friends. Very few go on to become true romantic partners. And so I think the dating apps have trained people for a lot of the behaviors that we're seeing now with these more kind of targeted interest apps.
Now, you mentioned earlier that COVID changed how people meet and interact. And I mean, part of that was because a lot of people were not meeting up and it was just a different dynamic. So did some of these apps become more popular during that time, but then, you know, certain ones just stuck more than others?
I definitely think there's an element of that. I actually did research right at the start of COVID, looking at how people were using dating apps. And it's interesting. So looking at dating apps, people in March and April of 2020 were really open to using them, mm-hmm. because they were like, I'm at home. In many cases, I'm home alone. And so now is a chance to really try and, you know, talk to people, put myself out there. But what I think happened, and what has kind of continued since that time, is there's been a lot of dating app burnout. And so I think, to your point, since COVID, we've seen the evolution of things like Goodreads, Letterboxd, Strava, because they're allowing similar behaviors of, you know, exploring myself, you know, looking what I'm interested in, but then also connecting with others. And I think another big element of this post-COVID is there's not as much pressure. You know, when you're on a dating app, dating is in the name. And so I think that always has this association of, okay, what am I really looking for? Whereas at the end of the day, if you're on Letterboxd, like I'm a Letterboxd user.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like that can be for you as much as it can be to connect with other people.
So Letterboxd is for movie reviews. Is that you get on and you talk about movies, you review them?
Yes.
Okay. So you can connect with people over your favorite shared movie. I'm sure you can find people who you want to go see a movie with, but you can also just talk about them together.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's been a lot of talk over several years, even before COVID, about whether dating apps have consumers' best interest in mind, or if it's just getting more people to use the app and stay on it longer. Are they really trying to help people get the best matches, or are people realizing that on dating apps, maybe that's not happening?
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause for a dating app, whether Tinder, Hinge, Bumble, you know, the list continues to grow, they do have to have people getting matches and they do need success stories, right? Like it's not just saying, okay, we want people on here and we want them swiping endlessly. There has to be some hook. And so there does have to be some people at least getting good matches. But to your point, I do think there's a trade-off where you don't want everyone getting on and matching with that first person and saying like, okay, good, we found our match and we're done, because these are businesses. And I do think it's easy to forget that, especially for people who are looking for really serious relationships. These are companies that are trying to make a profit, and they're also trying to collect a lot of data on their online daters. And that's another element of this, is that the data that swiping produces, that, you know, uploading photos of yourself, like that's really rich data that these companies definitely take advantage of. And so I think this is part of why I think this is such an interesting area to even study, is there really is this fine line between what's good for consumers versus what's good for the business. And those definitely don't always align.
This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Catherine Coduto, an assistant professor of media science at Boston University, who researches online dating and online behaviors. I've always wondered, you know, as we're talking about all these apps and having competition and whether they have the best interest of people in mind, how come something like Instagram or X, how come they have never implemented dating into their apps?
You know, I think that's a really great question. And I think, you know, there's probably been discussions that we don't know about, I'm sure, with something like Instagram, because it's part of the Meta family. And Facebook has tried Facebook dating, and, you know, people definitely use that. But I also think there's something to just kind of natural human behavior that occurs on these apps. And so I'm so glad you brought Instagram up, because that is something that a lot of people do kind of casually use as a dating app. And so I think if Instagram were to try and kind of commodify that, there would be backlash, you know, and that's where that term like sliding into your DMs, that's where it comes from. Messaging each other through Instagram. And so I think in some of these cases, the apps, you know, and the people working at them, they kind of know better than to push it any further. I also think there's a difference with something like Instagram or Twitter, maybe not quite as much, but you tend to know a lot of those people already. So I think for a lot of people, you're following friends, and maybe that's just a way to escalate the relationship with a friend. Whereas Tinder, Hinge, you're trying to find people you've never met before.
Yeah, I guess maybe TikTok could also be lumped in
Definitely.
There as well. Definitely. Because
Definitely.
If you follow someone's video and you figure out that you live in the same city as them, then you could message them and say, I like your videos. Hi.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. But that could also be in the more, I mean, some people on TikTok, depending on what videos are gaining traction, it's kind of like a hobby. You know, if people are doing unboxing videos or makeup tutorials, right? And that appeals to you.
Definitely. And I think that ties into some of those looking for clues of similarity. Mm-hmm. And so I think someone who's doing like an unboxing video, if you're like, oh, I'm really interested in like what it is they're displaying, then I think you're right. You could send the message and say like, hey, I really like this. And then maybe we meet up, or maybe we just continue this online only interaction.
Right. Well, this segment was inspired by one of our interns, our student producer, who saw that Ohio State students created an app that's called DuoDate for group dating. His name is Nick Saras. He's one of the co-founders. He told a local TV station that there were concerns about safety and meeting up with strangers, and that led to the creation of this app. So that sounds sensible to me. Rather than going on a one-on-one date, going out on a group date. Have you seen this trend?
Absolutely. And actually, so I'm in Boston now, and but I went to Ohio State.
Oh, hi. I feel like I need to say go Bucks to you then,
yeah,
or something. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But in Boston, we also have an app that has started up here, and it's called Foreplay, F-O-U-R, Play. The same idea that instead of having one-on-one dates, you go on a group. And so you sign up in pairs. So like you and your best friend could sign up and say, we're looking for, two men, two women, whatever, to go together. And that definitely stems from a lot of safety concerns and feeling like when you're by yourself, regardless of gender identity, you don't know who that other person might be, what their intentions might be. And so there is a layer of safety when you have another person to kind of help verify. And so I definitely think group dates, and particularly apps to help group dates, have really taken off.
And another thing I wanted to ask you about Strava, the running app, is it says that it shows that 1 in 5 of its active Gen Z members have been on a date with someone they met through a fitness club. So are you seeing that there's a lot of camaraderie around, the fitness industry and the idea of connecting with people?
Yes. And it's really interesting. Run clubs in particular have really grown in the last year or so.
Well, and that would be a group date too, going on a group run.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because again, you have layers of safety. You have the layers of what we have in common, the shared interest. There's also just the fact that when you're on something like Tinder, you'll see a lot of people say like, oh, I'm really active, or I'm really into running, or I'm really into hiking. But you just don't know that they're being totally honest about that. And so it goes back to what we talked about earlier, that, when you're signing up for Strava or you're joining a run club, you're putting that at the forefront of your goals. You're not putting that relationship at the forefront. And so I think that takes the pressure away. And so then I think it actually allows people, when you're in that situation, to kind of be more open to getting to know those around you. That's also another element, is that you're not just focused on one person. When you join a run club, you're going to meet a lot of different people, and then maybe you have one that really stands out.
Yeah. And we spent a lot of this segment talking about Gen Z or younger people, but I was also reading a story about older people using dating apps. Are you seeing different trends with them as well? Are they still using the traditional dating apps, or are they moving into hobby apps too?
I would say what I've seen in my own data so far are that older adults, so particularly like older Gen X and boomers and on up, they are tending to use more of the traditional dating apps, and they actually have a lot of optimism about them, because what the data tend to show for this group is that they're often using them after going through a divorce or separation or becoming widowed. And so they're like, I have relationship experience. Like, I've kind of already done this once, but I didn't have dating apps the first time around. And so now I'm really interested to see like what can this do for me? And so right now in my own data, at least, I tend to see that I'm actually surprised by how optimistic older adults tend to be about the current kind of realm of dating apps.
Maybe it's because they don't know how to meet people, so they see this as a way of
definitely
of doing
yeah.
that. Yeah, because they're out of practice or don't understand.
Yeah, and it's easy.
Right.
It's easy. Put on your phone and you're good.
Well, and maybe an older generation won't lie, I guess, because you've already been, maybe if you've already been through a bunch of relationships, it doesn't help anything to lie about, right?
Yeah, that's a very optimistic take.
Okay, I'll have an optimistic take. I'm sure some older people do lie, but okay, so what is the next step for your research for online dating? Where do you think you're going to take it from here?
Oh, what a great question. I think there's a lot to continue digging into. I would say one of my two main areas, of course, is starting to look into how AI plays into this. Artificial intelligence comes up a lot in these conversations, especially with looking at how people incorporate AI as like a helper with writing messages or creating their profiles. And so I definitely have some work coming up on that. But then I'm also just always interested in how people swipe. And so looking at, as they have more dating app options, as they're maybe exploring things like Goodreads or Letterboxd, are they still swiping a lot or are they trying to focus their attention elsewhere? So I would say that those are my two kind of main prongs right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of AI, but you could, if you have a direct, if you want to DM someone, you could write a few sentences and then tell AI, make me sound smarter, right?
Exactly. And I think that's going to be a really, like, people are already doing that. And I think we're only starting to see the beginning of what that will mean for the start of lots of relationships.
All right. Well, we'll have to have you back to talk whenever you have some research on that of so it's not just lying in the app, but now you're not authentically like writing something. So,
Exactly. Yes,
yeah.
I'll let you know.
Okay, great. Well, thank you to Catherine Caduto, an assistant professor at Boston University who researches online dating. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we will talk with Russell Hawley about Wi-Fi on airplanes and King Charles's playlist. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Durovich, and this is Tech Tuesday. If you've ever been frustrated with slow airplane Wi-Fi, then Starlink's new in-flight Wi-Fi system is your solution. Last year, United Airlines announced a deal with SpaceX to install its Starlink satellite Wi-Fi hardware into United's fleet of aircrafts. Joining us now to talk about that and some other tech news is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, new Wi-Fi on airplanes. I mean, everyone wants the Wi-Fi to be free on airplanes, but hey, we'll get there someday. So, tell me about United Airlines and what they're doing.
I don't know about free, but definitely faster. That seems to be the big goal right now. There's, there's typically two different forms of getting internet to an airplane. The one I think most people know is Gogo in-flight internet, where it's basically just antennas on the ground that, shoot up along the airline flight to make sure that you have internet. That's like the slowest version of the internet that's available on planes right now. And they had over the last couple of years switched to a satellite-based service that is more or less the same basic concept, just the internet's coming from above instead of from below, from satellite providers that are able to deliver, kind of greater capacity. And amongst the different satellite providers, Starlink is by far the fastest. And so what you're going to see here is United be able to offer, to the individual flights, internet speeds of up to 250 megabytes per second, which is unlikely to be something that you're able to get from your laptop or phone, but it would certainly be much faster than what is currently available from United, Southwest, and the different competitors.
Now, I read in the article on CNET that a part of this is that the equipment that Starlink needs to be on the plane to make this work is a lot lighter than other equipment. That hadn't even occurred to me that it's going to weigh down the plane to have internet.
Yeah, I mean, it's every little piece that you add to a plane, right? Everything, kind of adds up when it comes to that sort of thing. Starlink satellite receivers are, in fact, a great deal smaller than most of the others that are on there. But the service that ends up being offered is probably where we're going to see kind of the greatest thing there. Not only is it lighter, it's quite a bit more expensive, to an individual. If you were to purchase Starlink on your own versus another satellite provider, the trade-off there is that you're getting performance increase. So it's very unlikely that this is something that's going to end up being free to the user. But if you are the kind of person who takes those long haul flights and you really need to be able to like work while you're doing that, or if you're just a big fan of watching movies that aren't available on the, the in-flight thing, then, you'll be able to do that on these planes. United has not made any current statements about what this would end up costing the individual user, but it's likely that's something that will be announced before the end of the year.
Okay, so this is just being installed now. There's United Flights don't have it right this second.
That's right. The very first plane that it's been installed on was completed earlier this week, and it is now running test flights in order to gauge, you know, speed and performance differences before it gets rolled out to the rest of the fleet. So this is something that you'll likely see United be able to tout within the next couple of months, that, you know, individual planes will be enhanced by Starlink and that performance increase would come along with it. But it'll be a while before that's something that's rolled out to all United planes. And even then, we just don't know what that's going to end up costing the user.
Okay, so they haven't released a price, and it'll probably be different for like United Miles members versus the general public, I would guess. Who knows?
I'm sure that there's going to be some tiers associated with it. It wouldn't be impossible to think of it the same way that you would think of hotel Wi-Fi, you know, where you can have that really, really base layer for, you know, relatively little. But then if you want more of that performance, then you'd end up paying extra for it.
See, and that is why I said to you, I was like, maybe someday internet will be free on a plane, because we used to pay. I can remember paying for Wi-Fi at a hotel, and now it's, you don't have to do that anymore. It's just included in the cost of your room. So I'm
optimistic. That is very true.
Yeah.
We are, however, on the exact same day that we're having this conversation, Southwest just announced that they are going to start charging for bags, which is something that they have not done for 50 years. So I would guess that this is not the kind of thing that we would get for free anytime soon.
Right, right. Everything costs something at some point. So, so the internet, just having it available on a plane for everyone, the old tale that we used to always get told is that having everyone on the internet on a plane interferes with equipment. Is that not an issue really anymore?
Oh, so, you know, in most cases, you know, you think about the tools that would cause interference by way of using cellular service, because the frequencies were the same as the frequencies that the emergency communication would happen on. That is just very different now. Most Wi-Fi services that you use inside your home, they broadcast at very different frequencies than commercial airlines use for things like emergency communication. So it was certainly a problem at one point, but because of the way that both of those technologies has evolved, it's not nearly as big an issue anymore.
This is Tech Tuesday, and this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Holly, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. So the newest DJ for Apple Music is one of the most famous people in the world, King Charles. Why is King Charles a DJ at Apple?
You might not even know why.
Great question. Yeah. Why?
Yeah, I don't know that we're ever going to get an answer to why, other than if you watch The Crown, which is a very silly thing that is not actually real life, but you see evidence of kind of constant efforts to bring British royalty into, you know, kind of modern day and have it seem, you know, as though they are with the people. I'm not going to speculate any further.
I'm going to rephrase the question. Why not? Right? Why not? Of course.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, King Charles is apparently someone who has had a love of music his entire life and has never been shy about sharing that. And so the goal there was to, you know, kind of partner with Apple in order to have a radio station, you know, kind of quote unquote radio station, that is a collection of music that King Charles III is a big fan of. And so you can go through and you can listen to the same music that in theory he listens to in his day-to-day life.
I heard a story about this on NPR yesterday, and an example they used is they played like a little intro of him introducing the song Locomotion, and I thought, how fun.
There's actually a pretty diverse group of artists that are a part of this list, which includes Grace Jones, Kylie Minogue, Bob Marley. You know, just to name a couple, it's a pretty diverse list if this is actually his listening habits. That's really interesting.
So how do you think King Charles is going to be involved in the actual programming? I can't say that, you know, I've listened to Apple Music sometimes, but I can't say I've listened to like a channel with like a quote unquote DJ. Is he going to be on like every day?
No. So the way that a lot of those work is there are a couple of recorded messages from whoever the host of that station is.
Yeah.
Apple's, you know, radio stations, they vary pretty wildly from having a live host that is like, you know, kind of actively working like you would expect for a terrestrial radio station to operate. But a lot of them are, you know, kind of pre-recorded stations that have large collections of songs that will play with some interstitials, either, from that person or from someone in their orbit, as you've seen with other, you know, kind of celebrity stations that exist there. And this is very much going to be the latter. We're not going to hear live addresses from the King, you know, on Apple Music. He's not going to be, you know, kind of dropping beats and telling you, you know, what the upcoming song is or anything like that. But you will, you know, hear him at the intro, you know, introducing his station for the first time. And then all of the music, according to Apple and according to the royal family, is something that has been selected by the King.
I'm sure you don't know this, but it makes me curious as to whether the King Charles and company, his PR team, approached Apple or if Apple approached him.
Yeah, we don't know the introduction there and how that worked out. There is also quite a bit of speculation about whether Apple, in order to secure this deal, made a contribution to a charity fund on behalf of His Majesty. Mm-hmm. That there's just a lot of details around this deal that are not super clear. And it's likely that they won't come out anytime soon. But there's almost assuredly been money changing hands in one direction or another in order to make this happen.
What are your thoughts on... because there's a lot of celebrity radio stations everywhere from Sirius XM to Spotify to Apple Music. Is there going to be a bidding war between celebrities to try to see who can get a station?
It genuinely wouldn't surprise me, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that if it turns out to be very successful for Apple and Apple can demonstrate that this is something that either people actively subscribe to or that, you know, that they were willing to, you know, kind of up a subscription in order to get into, that would cause a kind of bidding war between Spotify and some of the others to have those, you know, kind of curated playlists by people that are, you know, kind of viewed as important in that, you know, day to day.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. How does Apple benefit from this? But I guess it's that more subscribers who like The Crown.
Apple needs to be able to say on a pretty regular basis that they not only have a fair number of subscribers, but daily active users. And so being able to constantly put out new ways for people to consume music is a good way to make sure that there's always someone kind of browsing around and doing things within the app instead of just opening the app and hitting play and, you know, kind of driving for a while. It's that, you know, kind of constant daily use that is a metric that is very important to Apple. Mm.
All right. Well, we'll see if King Charles kicks up that metric for them. The last topic I wanted to talk to you about is, have you ever thought about getting a backup battery for your home? Well, they can be expensive and are not easy to install, but a new company hopes to change that. Russell, tell us about the Pilla backup battery. Is it Pilla? P-I-L-A.
Yes, Pilla. There's a lot of different ways that you can introduce battery backups or power backups into your home, either generators or, you know, kind of great big solar battery situations. Often they need to be professionally installed because they're wired directly into the mains, so that you can, you know, kind of flip a switch and have all the power in your house come back on and there's no interruption in service. That's not always an option for everyone. So Pilla's whole deal is having great big batteries that can you yourself set up in the house in order to deliver power to very specific parts of your house. So let's say, you know, you have your power goes out regularly, you know, maybe because of fires in Southern California. And so what you really just need is to make sure that you have enough power to keep the refrigerator on for a couple of hours. That's what this is built for. It's built for, you know, kind of individual appliance use or for, you know, kind of extended delivery use and not for, you know, kind of delivering power to the whole house. And because it doesn't have to be powered directly into kind of your main power, it's something that can be installed yourself and it's designed to be really kind of flat and wide so that you can do things like set it on top of a refrigerator and then not have to worry about it.
So is it something you have to keep charged? You have to remember to have it plugged in so that it's ready to go when you need it, or is it solar powered?
So you can introduce solar power to this, but the goal there would be to have it, you know, kind of a power cord comes into this to, you know, charge it and deliver power to it. And then another cord would go from this to, say, a refrigerator or something important like that. And so when the power fails, the battery just immediately kicks in and starts doing its thing.
Oh, okay. So if you wanted it to be, you wouldn't just like move it around your house. You would have it set where you're like, this is going to power my refrigerator if the power goes out.
Yeah, you'd have the ability to move it around if you wanted to. I mean, they are still pretty big batteries, so you'd have to be, you know, kind of relatively strong in order to move it around from place to place, but it is definitely possible.
So it's relatively big. Is this something we can buy online right now and have it shipped to our house?
That is correct. Okay. So there's currently, Pilla has this early access program that they're doing. Where they're relatively low cost, and I say relative because some of these batteries can get up in like $30,000 to, you know, kind of have a thing for your home, but this starts at $1,000.
Oh, okay.
And there are federal tax credits that currently exist, where if you own, if you spend a certain amount on batteries that are of a certain size, and there's a 30% tax credit that goes along with it, and that applies to two or more of these batteries because of their cost.
Now, what is the advantage of having these batteries in your house over having a generator?
I mean, having a battery in your house just means that you're not worried about whether or not you need to provide fuel, the maintenance associated with it, for generators in particular. There are some great advantages to having generators, especially because batteries run out, and if you are in the middle of a storm or something like that, then there isn't more sun coming in. So it's really just whatever is best for your specific environment. That would, kind of be the best way to go. This is very much for someone who is not interested in, kind of being reliant on fossil fuels to power their house in an emergency, and just wants to be able to power, kind of one or two substantial appliances in their home.
Now, we have just about a minute left. Pilla is focusing on a mesh network it creates, instead of just investing in one big unit. What does that mean, a mesh network?
So the goal there, if you have, kind of multiple important things in the house, then you have two or three of them, and they would all more or less talk to one another, so that you would be aware of how much battery power is left across them, and you'd be able to see it on the kind of control panel that exists on it, and you'd be able to make adjustments based on that.
Oh, okay, so if the battery running your refrigerator is running out, you can tell it to, like, I don't need, I don't know, the washing machine to work. You can make the refrigerator go. That's
That's exactly right.
okay. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us. That is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. Thank you, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides. I'm Amy Jarovich on 89.7 NPR News.